Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Trump and Attorney General Bill Barr both make news with Constitution Day speeches, plus a Pennsylvania court rules to allow late ballots in November, even if they lack a postmark. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jagot. We are joined today by my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, happy Friday, Kyle.
Happy Friday, you beat me to the punch. And Bill McGurn, hello, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
So Thursday was Constitution Day, September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of America's founding document in Philadelphia. And let's talk about two speeches given, starting with Donald Trump's. Speaking from the National Archives in Washington, the home of the Constitution, as well as the Declaration of Independence. And if you haven't seen it for yourself, you really should go. President Trump said this, quote, "Our mission is to defend the legacy of America's founding, the virtue of America's heroes, and the nobility of the American character. We must clear away the twisted web of lies in our schools and classrooms and teach our children the magnificent truth about our country." Kim, is that really the state of America's schools in 2020?
I actually think he's got a point, and I think that this is an issue that has grown in people's mind. It's been concentrated in the past couple of months because of the protests that we have seen, and now the open calling to, you know, tear down statues, this cancel culture, which has really escalated in the last few months, in that if you don't say the exact politically correct issue, don't use the right phraseology, you can lose your job, or, you know, you can be blackballed from polite society, thrown off social media. But it goes back to, it's, yes, the last couple of months, as I said, have concentrated, but, you know, we were having people starting to kneel during the national anthem at sporting events a while ago. We've had the 1619 Project going on, redefining American history and placing it in the context of slavery, and that is it. Defining feature. And going back even farther than that, you have, I think, growing frustration among parents in particular with curriculum. And those were some of the fights that used to be really prominent in this country before we got to the kind of crazy days of Trump's presidency. So this is something that I think potentially holds some real appeal out there, not just for Donald Trump's base, but for a lot of people that in general have anger and frustration at what is taught at schools and what kids are learning these days about their history and their country's past.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, has something fundamentally changed here? I mean, Trump mentioned the 1619 Project, which, as Kim says, in its own words, is trying to, quote, reframe the country's history. But he also mentioned, what he called propaganda tracts from Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history, he said. And Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, was first published in 1980 and has been sparking controversy, especially its use in classrooms, for a long time. So, Bill, I mean, is this just the same push and pull over the teaching of American history, or do you think there's something different about what's happening now?
Well, I think both are true. Look, Howard Zinn has been around for a long time, writing this kind of thing. But until recently, these kind of views, I mean, look, the basis of the 1619 Project is that America was founded with the stain of slavery, a corrupting Senate that has kept it fundamentally corrupt or systematically racist, whichever you choose, ever since and beyond repair. Now, that, again, Howard Zinn, other people have said similar things over the last century about the United States, but they've always been on the fringe before. That's what's so significant about the 1619 Project. It was done via the Times and an attempt to mainstream these ideas. And so gone, the problem with this view is that there's no room for any discussion or nuance, and especially in judging human beings. So someone like Thomas Jefferson may write very inspiring words, give us the Declaration of Independence that's inspired a lot of people to freedom, and he owned slaves, right, at one point. And there's no way to judge human beings as human beings to say, well, this was good, this was bad. Now you're utterly condemned, canceled, have your statues torn down. It's just crazy. And again, I think the big difference now is that it's a mainstream view. And I think it's behind a lot of the protests, the soft approach to the protest. A lot of Democratic leaders seem unable to condemn the people protesting because they kind of accept the same moral premises as a lot of the protesters. In fact, a lot of the mayors have joined in some of the protesters. So I think that's the difference, that that these attitudes about the United States that have been on the fringes for decades are now coming into the mainstream. And they'll be coming to the schools pretty soon, too.
Yeah, perhaps less on the fringes, though I do sort of wonder still whether if you went to a random school district or the median school district, whether they would have any Howard Zinn on the shelf there. But let's talk about what the president proposes to do about this. So he said in his speech that the National Endowment for the Humanities would be giving out a grant to develop what he described as a pro-American curriculum that celebrates the truth about our nation's great history. And then he also said he would sign an executive order to establish a national commission to promote patriotic education. Kim, what do you make of this idea, and do you think it'll be effective?
Well, to be honest with you, anytime any politician or president, whether on the right or left, says that they're going to develop a commission, it's my cue to snooze. Just because, you know, commissions, there are a million of them in Washington. They can have some influence over aspects of policy. I think even the president noted, though, that this commission will encourage our educators to teach our children about the miracle of American history and make plans to honor the 250th anniversary of our founding, end quote. So they're going to go out there with some recommendations, but no one's going to necessarily have to follow them. The grants could be more interesting in my mind because there is an interesting call out there, need out there to talk about how we our curriculums at a local level. And I think a lot of school districts, in the absence of having any guidance from any sort of official body, they do tend to come under the influence of outside groups who put a lot of pressure on them to teach a certain type of history or to focus in particular on aspects of history rather than the broad scope of things. And that pressure can be very, very profound, especially at local levels. So if you have some sort of a grant that's going to encourage an outfit to come up with something that's inspiring and enlightening, or you have a commission doing the same, giving some advice, I mean, maybe it will lead to, you know, will simply provide more options out there and give those who want to see a broader view of American history a kind of fighting chance, the tools, as it were, to try to get some of that back into curriculums at the school level. But it's not a mandate, so it is what it is.
Right, and so it seems like any curriculum that is devised here will have to stand or fall on its own merits because there's local control of schools in the United States, and in the past bill, there's been lots of skepticism of national curriculum and, for example, a lot of opposition a few years ago to the Common Core standards.
Right. I actually agree with Kim's skepticism, and I would go even farther. I'm very skeptical about any federal commission these days. I mean, one of the things is we do not have a national consensus anymore, and Donald Trump may set up one with all historians that I really respect and so forth, but I wonder what that commission would become under a Biden administration. I think it'd be made up of all Howard Zinns or his like. Look, there's no shortage of good curricula out there. There's no shortage of good works. I'd rather see the private sector doing it. You know, one area where they are doing it, homeschooling. There's no centralized homeschooling authority, but there are all these curricula that have been developed that are really excellent and that parents can find and get. I don't see why a group of historians couldn't come together privately and then issue their recommendations. You know, even if you didn't take it literally each thing, it would be good to have some people gather around an idea and try to do an old-fashioned civics course that refers to, as Kim says quite rightly, the miracle of American history and the self-corrections in our history, on slavery and Jim Crow and so forth. And I think it can be done. I'm skeptical of the government doing it. I think it may sound good on the political trail for Donald Trump to say, let's put together this thing and have the authority. I wonder about the long-term prospects for such a commission.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's move on to a second Constitution Day speech. This one actually delivered on Wednesday, so Constitution Day Eve. And that was from Attorney General Bill Barr visiting Hillsdale College, talking about making the argument that the Justice Department's power is vested in the Attorney General. And a couple of lines from his written remarks. He said, quote, "The Attorney General, senior DOJ officials, and U.S. attorneys are indeed political, but they are political in a good and necessary sense," unquote. And then he went on to say, "Letting the most junior members set the agenda might be good philosophy for a Montessori preschool, but it's no way to run a federal agency." So, Kim, a little bit of a jab there, but I think he makes a reasonable point.
His speech was excellent, and it's one that I would advocate anyone right now who's listening to this podcast, go and find the full text of it, sit down and read it. I think it's one of the best descriptions that I have seen from a politician in recent years or in a very long time about the necessity of having political accountability. And, you know, some of those jabs that he took, it has allowed, you know, it riled people. It was so fascinating to see the Washington Post complete misinterpretation of this, or the way that they described this, which was utterly divorced from reality. They say the whole speech was a, quote, "breathtaking broadside," end quote, against the professional attorneys in the Department of Justice. And you had other liberals out there tweeting that this was a dangerous speech, that it was an absurd speech. Richard Blumenthal, the Connecticut senator, called Mr. Barr a disgrace. But what he was really saying, and I think it's important, is just that you can have this body of career prosecutors, and it's not saying that they're not good and that you don't need to trust them, but that fundamentally the power of those prosecutors is so huge that you have to have somebody that, as the Constitution requires, was named and confirmed, named by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and accountable to the people for the actions of those attorneys. You know, and this has been really a very big and important theme over the last couple of years, especially if you've seen this, you know, I mean, Donald Trump would call them the deep state, but a bunch of people within the bureaucracy whose attitude seems to be that if you, Bill Barr, as the Attorney General, tell them that they can't do something, that you are somehow interfering with justice. And it's the other way around. You know, they are allowed to go out and do their work, but the guy who was actually named by the president, confirmed by the Senate, is responsible for making the final call because he's responsible to the people. And yeah, that's not the world the Washington Post would like to see, especially when there's a Republican president and a Republican Attorney General, but it's the way the Constitution viewed this and set it out.
And so, to make it a little bit concrete, I mean, we've talked on this program a little bit about the Roger Stone case and also the Mike Flynn case. And I mean, the gist here, as I understand it, Bill, is that you can look at the facts of those and criticize the facts of what the Department of Justice did in those cases. Or I suppose you could say that they're one-sided in their handling of cases. But the idea that the buck for those prosecutions doesn't stop on the Attorney General's desk, and that he's interfering if he gets involved in those cases, just doesn't wash.
Right. It's insane. I mean, our Constitution clearly lays out the power. They all work for the President of the United States, who's in charge of the legislative branch. Because the government has grown so big with so many bureaucracies, there does seem to be, I don't want to use words like the deep state, but there is a permanent bureaucracy. These people mostly have lifetime jobs as civil servants. And there tends to be a view among many, especially those on the left, that the incoming administration or whatever party, they're a bunch of yahoos that don't know any better, and we'll lead the way. And that, as Kim says, our Constitution begins with we the people, not we the federal bureaucracy, right? That's what it's based on. And there is this view that they're somehow above it. And in fact, because they are above it, in the sense that they're insulated, they're protected, can't really get fired. Because they're insulated, that makes it very dangerous, because there's no accountability. And so Bill Barr is not the first person to say this. You know, Republican administrations, it's usually complaining about the State Department filled with career people that have a different agenda from the president. I mean, Ronald Reagan complained about it and so forth. And I suspect that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had their own complaints about different bureaucracies that were thwarting what they wanted to do. It's a tension that's inherent in the government, especially of this size. But again, I don't think there's any question that the final authority is the president, because if you don't have the final authority of the president and his cabinet secretaries acting in his name, then you have no authority at all.
But the broad principle, it seems to me, is widely applicable beyond the law and including in public health. I mean, there are a lot of arguments going on right now about what steps the government should take. In separate remarks this week, the Attorney General Bill Barr said this. He said, "The person in the white coat is not the grand seer who can come up with a right decision for society. A free people makes its decision through its elected representatives," which it seems to me, Kim, like he's making a similar point, though it's a bit of a subtle point. And the article I was reading this in set up this quote by saying that the Attorney General was saying that the federal response to the pandemic should be guided by politicians instead of scientists, which to me is a complete misreading. I mean, his argument is that the people who need to make the final call need to be the people that are fireable by the electorate.
Absolutely. Look, the reason we have doctors and scientists who work in administrations is because we recognize they have a certain amount of expertise. And their job there is to pass along that expertise and offer their opinions and their judgments to the elected and accountable officials, who then carry that information with them, blend it in with other things that they're getting, because that's the other thing as well, too. The United States is not governed by science, okay? Science alone doesn't dictate the complexities of modern American life. You have to care about the economy, okay? You have to care about education. You have to care about all these different questions that go into having a functioning and successful and upwardly mobile country. Science is one aspect of that. Health is one aspect. So you have the elected officials who are getting information from the experts across all of those fields. They're hearing from a Dr. Fauci, but they're also hearing from a Larry Kudlow, an economic advisor to the president. And then they put all that information together and make the final call. You know, and one thing just on this, which I find kind of interesting, and it's also a subtle point in line with the Attorney General's, but I think that what exposes the fallacy of that argument, the notion that this should be driven by science and that politicians should have no role in this, is that science doesn't agree with each other, right? I mean, one of my complaints about the entire beginning of this virus is that that we were relying almost entirely on a very tiny handful of scientists who just happened to be in the U.S. government at this moment in time. It didn't necessarily mean they were the best prepared for this particular situation. It didn't mean that their views had been ones that had been vetted and ought to be trusted automatically. They just happened to be there. And I had kind of wished at the time that the administration had invited a whole bunch of people in to get a lot of different views. But look at what has happened in the last few weeks. We've had Scott Atlas, a doctor, a scientific guy from Stanford, come in. He's got a slightly different view of, or a significantly different view on this virus, where it's headed and our ability to beat it. And he's been pilloried by the press. So, you know, they acknowledge in doing so that there's only certain science that they like on certain times of the day coming from certain mouths. And that, again, proves why you need to have accountable people, elected people making the final call.
Yeah, Kyle, I'd add just one thing that illustrates this. In our system, the president is the commander in chief, right? If there were any area where you'd say, let the experts decide, it'd be generals, right? Now, the president seeks the advice of generals on how to do something, but our system deliberately doesn't give the generals the final say on this. And much less do the generals let some corporal or second lieutenant second guess them. You have to have some level of accountability. And if on something as important as this, we're putting a layman who may have no military experience in charge of defending the country and making these life or death decisions. And we do that again because there's accountability.
Finally, the news on Thursday from Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court there issued a ruling extending the ballot deadline. Pennsylvania law says that absentee votes to be valid have to arrive by 8 p.m. on November 3rd. But the court now says that ballots must be counted if they arrive by November 6th. And interestingly, Kim, they don't apparently even need a postmark, because ballots without a postmark, or if the postmark is illegible, the ruling says will be presumed to have been mailed by election day unless evidence suggests otherwise.
Yeah, if you want a sterling example of the problems of a liberal court, look at this right here. There's nothing in the statute that says anything about what the court just ruled. They're just making it up. And with, by the way, potential enormous consequences, because if, you know, especially the point about not having a postmark on there, you know, can anyone just drop off anything? Can it just be counted? If we are also at the point of having a very close election, Pennsylvania is going to be absolutely critical to that. Basically, the court has already, with this decision, has already guaranteed that we're not going to get an answer from Pennsylvania likely on election night unless somebody just storms through the state one side or the other and wins an enormous amount of the vote. But again, I go back, I think the most disturbing aspect about this is simply the court deciding that it has the authority to make up voting rules, because this has nothing to do with what the Pennsylvania legislature has laid out in law and has envisioned for the rules governing state voting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The first negative outcome that I see of this is we are not probably going to get a result from Pennsylvania on election day. I mean, there are other hangups that could have prevented that already. Pennsylvania does not start processing absentee ballots until election day. And so there were questions about whether the process could even go fast enough to get a result, although the state legislature had been working on a bill that would change that. But now it seems likely that it's going to be even later. I mean, because if the public sees this ruling, Bill, I mean, thousands of voters may just decide, well, I mean, I'm going to take the extra time. I will mail my ballot on election day. So there will probably be a lot of ballots that come in afterward. And if it's a close election, we might not know the Electoral College for a while.
Yeah. Look, Ken said this is a liberal court. The real descriptor here is not liberal. It's lawless. As she said, there's nothing in the law that controls this. The law was pretty clear, and the court just undermined it. And this alone, even before we have the results, I think is going to undermine a lot of public confidence in the results. You know, you not only want to have results, but you want to have them presented in a way that the public has reasonable confidence that no one's been fooling around with the results or interfering. And all these things are just making it, especially in states where the margins are expected to be tight, are going to make it more likely that one or both sides contends that the results were doctored and that people don't have confidence with it. I do not see that as a prescription for a peaceful republic.
And it also seems to me that it makes it less likely that the legislature and the governor will come to an agreement to change other other things. For example, that issue of not opening ballots, absentee ballots, until Election Day. A second is the ballot deadline. So in Pennsylvania, you can request a mail vote 1 week before the election at 5 p.m., which does not give a whole lot of time. I mean, everybody recognizes that that's an unrealistic deadline, but they're disagreed about what to do about it. So the Democratic governor, Tom Wolf, has called for legislation to count late ballots. The Republican legislature has been moving a bill to go the other way, to move the request deadline earlier, to make it 15 days before the election. And now, Kim, it looks to me like, why does the governor need an agreement? He just got a lot of what he wanted from the court.
Well, exactly. And that's really a pity, because here's the thing, too. Apparently, all of this is being pushed along by the fact, or the reason the court ruled this way, is because of concerns that the United States Postal Service is not going to be able to deliver everything in time. And as people have pointed out, if you move up that deadline for requesting things, that you're going to have a better chance of stuff coming in and getting there on time. And so the proper way to have done this was for the legislature to step back. And this should be happening in every single state. For Republicans and Democrats to basically join hands and say, look, we are operating in an unprecedented environment, given the virus, given that some people are uncomfortable about going to the polls to vote. We should all care about making sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to do that. We should also care about the sort of sanctity of our elections and make sure that the results that we get can be counted and as quickly as possible and with great assurity so that people can have confidence in this. What do we need to do? And the obvious things obviously should be, you know, ways in which you speed up the deadlines or push back the, I rather like make sooner the deadlines for requesting ballots, and look at other aspects of this that will allow people to count things more quickly and be more definitive. And that shouldn't be that hard of a lift, but given what political football the entire voting question has been, it has been. And now, unfortunately, we have courts wading in and wading in for one side or the other. And that's just not something that's going to inspire confidence.
All right. Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.